Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you.
My guest this week is Reid Hoffman. Reid was a founding board member and executive vice president at PayPal, and in 2003, he co-founded LinkedIn, the world's largest professional networking service. He was an angel investor in Facebook and Zynga, and in 2009, became a partner at the venture capital firm Greylock Partners. He currently serves on the boards of Airbnb, Aurora, and Microsoft, among other companies. He's co-authored multiple books, including his most recent effort, Blitzscaling, the lightning-fast path to building massively valuable companies. In this interview, Reid argues that companies should value speed over efficiency. In the modern world of network effects, being the first to scale often provides significant first-mover advantages in creating a transformative company. While second place can be a decent consolation prize, Reid believes that if you are third or worse, you've failed. However, while speed is important, Reid warns against having a blind adhesion to size, as companies also need to determine which components put them in the best possible position. We also discuss the lessons Reid took from SocialNet, a company he founded before LinkedIn, his experience as a founding board member of PayPal, how China is able to move at such an extraordinary pace, and a variety of other topics. And now a word from our sponsor. Technovation is brought to you by Fortinet. I recently caught up with Fortinet's Chief Information Security Officer, Phil Quaid, and he discussed the expanding threat landscape that IT executives and companies more generally encounter daily, and the ways in which Fortinet's security fabric can help.
Almost every organization faces an expanding attack surface caused by digital transformation, threat actors that automate sophisticated attacks, and a growing cybersecurity skills gap. It's more urgent than ever for security leaders to not only be technologists, but strategists that can enable business. The fundamental elements of cybersecurity are speed and integration. Combined with segmentation and access control, you can build a foundation that tilts the odds in your favor, defending at your points of strength. Fortinet can help. Our security fabric spans your entire networked environment from the IoT endpoint through your core and into multi-cloud environments. We integrate each security element to address today's growing threat environment, protecting the expanding attack surface and reduce complexity. This enables actionable threat intelligence to be shared at speed and scale, and automated mitigations that shrink risk windows. It's the cybersecurity strategy and technology used to protect the highest end systems, and it's now accessible to both enterprise and SMB. Just because you cannot eliminate cyber risk does not mean that you cannot manage it. Build your strategy around speed, automation, and integration.
Let's get back to our interview.
Reid Hoffman, welcome to Technovation. It's so great to speak with you today.
It's great being here. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, thank you. So, Reid, I thought we would begin begin at the beginning of your business journey, which actually began extraordinarily young. You tell a great story in the final episode of Masters of Scale about your love of gaming, your love of D&D, Dungeons and Dragons. And there was a gaming company, Chaosium, who had a game called RuneQuest that you were obsessed with, and found out that I believe it was a friend of yours lived near the offices of the organization, and you had a little bit of feedback. Not only were you a fanboy and wanted to go sort of meet the executives, but you actually were able to get some feedback to the executives. I wonder if you could kind of retell that story, if you don't mind.
So it was kind of funny. I mean, maybe many kids have these total focus obsessions, but fantasy role-playing games when I was 12 were it's mine. And so when my friend said, oh, the offices of this game company that we play is in my residential neighborhood, it's nearby, and I'm allowed to go in because they're not really supposed to have offices in a residential neighborhood, so they're kind of nice to the neighbors. And I said, can I come in with you? It's a little presumptuous, but you know, you're a 12-year-old. And so I followed him in, and I went, and I had previously looked at one of the things that they had published, and I go, oh, this is wrong, and circled everything from, you know, the story arc should be different here, the math is bad here, the gameplay design needs to be fixed. And I had just done it because I was a geek. I was an otaku of like what fantasy role playing is. I had no other thing other than this is what my, you know, this is what I thought about between when I woke up and when I went to sleep. That was what I did every day. And so I went in and, you know, they're like, oh, great, 12 year olds, you know. And I was like, oh, here, I've made some edits to this thing you did. And I literally can still see in my head Steve Perrin rolling his eyes. He's like, and I was 12, so I didn't quite understand the, oh, God, this 12-year-old is handing me this thing that we published. Sure, sure. But to his credit, he, you know, intellectually curious, he opened, looked through and went, oh, interesting. And then he said, all right, well, I've got this other thing that we're working on. Would you mind taking a look at this for us? And so I took it home, and I think it was a Wednesday that I'd gone in, and it was like Thursday night, Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And then I went back on, I think it was Monday, because I think it was one of those Monday holidays, so I didn't have school. And so I went back on Monday, and I said, okay, here, I've done this. And so he looked through it, and he was like, okay, this is really good work. I'm going to give you a check. And so I brought my very first check home, and it shifted my dad from thinking, oh, God, I've lost my son to this weird cult fantasy role-playing system to, oh, maybe this is a job. And so that helped. And, you know, and then I stayed fairly closely connected to the Chaosium for a couple of years. And even one of the – had about 5 years back had coffee with one of the founders just catching up. And so it's it was a delightful journey of kind of like, here's how you can begin to express your creativity and – I wouldn't have put it this way at the time, be entrepreneurial.
Yeah. And it's really, it's amazing to think a 12-year-old having the chutzpah to do something like that. And I can only imagine the confidence it would have given you that here, somebody you admired, a company and a game that you admired, that all of a sudden you're having an influence over. Yeah. I can't even imagine what that must have been like.
So I, you know, maybe it was a little strange. I neither felt like proud, arrogant, nor insecure. It was just like, this is what I do. I'm obsessed about this. And if he had told me, oh, this feedback you're giving me is totally wrong, I would have gone, oh, really, why? Like, just like, okay, I'll learn from it. Like, it's like everything else is extraneous, right? It's just like, how do we do this well? Because, you know, for me, you know, part of the thing that was interesting about fantasy role-playing games, it was a way for us to almost like play it being adults, right? So it's the, what is the narrative arc of how we're going on the hero's journey of our lives? And yes, you had orcs and goblins and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Fine. It's just part of a narrative arc. And that was the thing that that made me really so obsessed and interested about it. And once I started actually getting a little older and becoming more of an adult myself, I was like, well, I don't need that anymore. We're now going through life.
And I wonder, you know, as I was reflecting on that story, having heard it before, it made me wonder, there's so many people, entrepreneurs, who go into business. An advantage they have is that they've never been in that industry before. And as a result, there's no inherited logic that they're adhering to. There's no shibboleths that they're bowing to, et cetera. And that gives them advantage because they are viewing a problem, maybe in some cases, that's been there for a long time in a completely different light. So in a similar way, you didn't know enough to know that this is really strange what you did.
Yes, right? Yeah, exactly. Actually, sometimes a lack of knowledge is very helpful because frequently, by the way, the tools or the nature of a problem change when the experts don't realize it's changed. So like a personal experience on the entrepreneurial side for me for that was PayPal. Because when we launched PayPal, none of us knew what a credit card chargeback was. We didn't know what it was. That was how out of touch with the financial system as it operated it was. And so we didn't really realize that no one had tried to do something like PayPal because they knew about things like fraud and they knew about criminal agents trying to do stuff and they knew about an industry is trying to essentially steal money from credit cards and so forth. We didn't know about any of that. We just thought, oh, this would be a useful service to exist. Now, fortunately for us, we were quick learners, right? Because otherwise we would have been dead. But that freshness of approach, what we tried some things that the traditional industry didn't try because probably when the traditional industry had learned the lessons of how to deal with fraud, the new tools weren't available. So we could go and learn and apply the new tools. And we had kind of – the way that I described it in the PayPal circumstances is we – kind of drove out halfway into a minefield. And once you're halfway into a minefield, you might as well go the whole way because you kind of went into the minefield. So it's like hit the accelerator and go as fast as you can. Anyway, so and that's one of the things that frequently that new mind part of entrepreneurship is actually very very helpful.
Yeah, that's interesting. One of the new mind and the new idea can be ahead of its time, though, to the detriment of the company that is being launched. And SocialNet is in some ways an example of that.
Yep.
An idea that is not so dissimilar for what would become LinkedIn. Certainly, you see a lot of the precursors to it, but it was really in many ways an idea ahead of its time. What's your diagnosis of the issues there?
So, actually, in fact, I think the idea the idea was incomplete.
Okay.
So it wasn't actually, in fact, and you could still do some of it. Like part of it was that what really mattered was our real life relationships. What really mattered was not, because back at the time it was like you go to cyberspace, you adopt a pseudonym. So like, you know, you're anime fan, not Reid Hoffman or, you know, that kind of thing. And you went there because this was this danger, wild, wild west space. And remember, this is kind of back in the thing when on the internet, no one knows you're a dog.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all of this kind of thing, because it was like, ooh, that's that weird new space that's totally different. And yet what really matters to us is our lives. What really matters to us is how we go through our life, our personal lives, our romantic lives, our work lives, and so forth. And I knew that at SocialNet. And so the thought was, how do you make a really great bi-directional matching system that's a platform that goes across all of these contexts of human life? That's still a useful thing. There may still be some way that that gets expressed in a company somewhere. But the thing that I had gotten wrong was the elements of how you start – part of starting a company and part of doing the startup and the scale-up successfully is some knowledge about how a business has grown in this space. And it could be a theory versus a knowledge, like it's new for everyone. You have a theory. Other people have a theory. And so the mistake I made was not thinking of the internet as an entirely new medium, that I went, yes, it was a new medium for a product. But like how you go to market, how you acquire your customers is as important as what business you construct. So all I thought it was about having a genius new business and then you would just go traditionally market it. So we went and did partnerships with newspapers and magazines and a bunch of other stuff. And one of the ones that I particularly remember is we put a lot of energy into doing a partnership with a newspaper in Arizona. And in the first month, we got 6 signups from that partnership. And when I was doing the debrief with my team, I said, look, if what we had done is taken all the time and energy we had put into the partnership and we'd literally opened a phone book and called people just walking down the white pages, calling the next person, we would have signed up many, many more people than the effort that we put into this. Okay. And that was an instance of know what in your approach, your go-to-market strategy should be. And so the things that were failures at SocialNet were not understanding virality. We're not understanding the dynamics of search engine optimization. We're not understanding what are the pattern by which it works here. And sometimes in the early internet, there was also just a natural growth of a lot of people saying, what's this internet thing? And so they would discover Yahoo and, you know, like what's that? But you have to understand what that pattern is. And my lesson wasn't so much as the idea was completely new. There were elements that needed to be better. So we also did the, your anime fan versus your Reid Hoffman. We didn't have the notion that your real relationships are the platform for all the applications. So there were new components to the product idea that came out earlier. But also was have as firm and as deep thinking on your go-to-market strategy as your product, as an entrepreneur. And that was one of the things that was kind of a key lesson that wasn't so much of an idea before its time as much it was a learn how to be an entrepreneur.
Which clearly you did. Yeah. Although before launching LinkedIn, an idea, as I understand it, that you had before full-time joining PayPal, you were on the board of the company.
Yeah.
Peter Thiel convinced you, no, don't do that yet. There's work you can do here. Can you talk a bit about what drew you in? Obviously, you were familiar with the company. You had been close with Peter Thiel, having gone to university with him. What was it about that opportunity that pushed you to sideline the idea that you've been thinking about?
Well, so the way it started is Max and Peter, who had met through a talk, Max Levchin, who had met through a talk that Peter was giving at Stanford, had come up with this idea of encryption on mobile phones as an interesting platform. And so Max and Peter each said, well, we'll have, you know, like our closest entrepreneur friend on the board to help us. So I was Peter's, Scott Bannister was Max's. And so they came to me and said, hey, we've got this really good idea and we want to start a company and you've been doing the startup stuff for a while and would you come help us? And my answer was, close friend, super happy to help you. Terrible idea. It's never going to work. And so, you know, like, let's go down this path, but it's not going to work. Now, one of the things I learned was super smart, hard-driving talent that is capable of learning and pivoting can generate to interesting things. Because if you had asked me to predict from that very first meeting, it was like, well, this is not going to go anywhere because getting people to adopt an encryption platform generically on mobile phones when you don't have a telco, you're not close to this at all, you have this theory that people will start using digital cash on their mobile phones for some reason, which is going to be arcanely difficult to do, right? This is back in flip phones. This is well pre-iPhone, et cetera. All that stuff, this is never going to work, right? Like that, that's not driving through a landmine field. That's like lining up the landmines and deliberately driving over each one of them. Right? So it's kind of like, okay, that's never going to work. Yeah. And so, and they iterated because it's super smart. And so that part of the thing that as on the board, they had gone from encryption platform on flip phones to encryption technology on Palm Pilots to a economic payment service on Palm Pilots and the web, and then quickly just had dropped to the web, and the web was beginning to take off. And so Peter's pitch was, look, we've got traction. We've done a whole bunch of pivoting. We found our way to, in modern lingo, as product market fit. And so that's a more useful tour of duty for you. That's a Reid Hoffman phrase. Again, new phrase, not then, but to essentially come do this first and then go do whatever else you wanted. And I was like, yep, product market fit really matters. That's really hard to find. Yes, let me come help here. And that's when I stepped off the board and joined the company full time.
And what, you know, as I think about one of the keys to LinkedIn success is carving out the space to connect people, especially in a business context, you know, developing this great network, being able to leverage that for the pursuit of ideas, to find new colleagues, et cetera. And the network that was developed within PayPal is almost miraculous. Mm-hmm. If you think about the people that were there at the outset and what they have done, what they did there, right? What you all did, I shouldn't say they. Mm-hmm. And what you have all done since. You've mentioned Peter Thiel. You've mentioned Max Levchin. You've not mentioned yet Elon Musk. And I mean, just extraordinary entrepreneurs. What was it about that union or that idea that brought these people together? And to what extent was that kind of that experience? How did it become so instrumental in launching all the things that have come since as well?
So a whole bunch of things that Peter and Max and then Elon later when he joined, yeah, we merged the companies X.com and PayPal together, learned from me. And there was a bunch of stuff I learned from them. Mm-hmm. And in particular, one of the things that was a Peter and Max reflex from the very early stages, now part of my tool chest as well, when I fund, you know, kind of startups at Greylock, when I build companies myself, is learning curve. And so what they had a bias to is, as opposed to hiring someone who had 10 plus years experience doing the thing before, they hired the person who was like, I am a voracious and quick learner, smart. I have baseline like engineering skills, but like, I am doing this to prove myself. I'm 25, 28, 30, and this is my shot. This is that, you know, like Hamilton or Eminem. This is my shot. That's what I'm really focused on. And then they put together a group of people who are like this, right? Inclusive of myself at that time. It was like, I was kind of a young kid who wanted to show that I could do things that were really interesting and important in the world and wanted to make that contribution, but I had not yet proven that I could do so. And that was it was a group of that sort of people. And then the other thing that got added to it, because many companies aggregate kind of talent in this amazing way, but when you have like a 10, 20 year run for where the company gets to, a lot of times at the end of it, it's like, okay, I've done all my stuff. PayPal got acquired in kind of 3 years, right? And so then you have all this talent because I still want to prove it. I've got some money in my pocket because the company worked. And a lot of us were contrarian enough that in 2002, when the general feeling of the valley was the internet was over, it was played out, it was Yahoo, it was Amazon, it was PayPal, you know, it was Google, it was like these were the companies, eBay.
The Blitzscalers.
Yeah, that was it. That was it. The internet's played out. We were all like, no, it's just starting. Yes, we're in this dip, but it's just starting. And so we had some ability to angel invest together, to talk about which ideas we'd be doing. And so we were all in communication because we all thought, the internet is just starting and we should go do more of this.
Hmm. So talk a bit about the inception then of LinkedIn. So obviously that's next for you.
Yep.
And, again, taking some of the learnings from SocialNet or even from your time at Apple before that. You've been in the social world for a while, an area of inspiration to you. What was different this time?
So what had happened is I had reflected on what had worked and not worked on SocialNet. And among the things was, like, we had emphasized the dating service because we knew that people would most naturally want that. So SocialNet was a platform across things, but we were much more like, people would say, oh, you're like Match.com. Because, you have, like, as everyone knows well, and single people, like, they're really willing to drop new things to try to find someone to connect with. And my actual learning on entrepreneurship had been, do the thing that people first think is crazy and 2 to 3 years in the future think is obvious. That's the contrarian and right part of it. So focus on the professional, the economic side of it, the thing that people would say, what? Like I know that your network matters, but those networking people, the people who walk up to you and say, hi, I'm Reid Hoffman, here's my business card at a cocktail party, you're like, ah, right? That, that's not what I do, and I've got those people make me uncomfortable. And so, but focus on that because that's actually the transformation of their economic life. And once you begin to prove how important and valuable it is to them, you'll then be unique in a category versus competing amongst 10, 20, 30 and so forth, because that's you start with, you're crazy, and then you go to, you are obviously right. And then apply a bunch of the things I'd learned. Use your real identity, use your real relationships, have virality as a core measure. And so I had been thinking about that as a thing I was going to go do when I was exiting SocialNet to go kind of go focus on this thing, which would be a very different shape service than SocialNet. But my learnings from how I would have done had I known this stuff in the future. Peter said, no, do PayPal first, did that. And then when we sold PayPal to eBay, I was like, well, wait, the idea's still there. Like because of the contrarian stuff, people haven't occupied this space yet. No one's really thought about this. And as I began to get into it, actually, I realized that people had just started thinking about it because there were enterprise versions. There was, these things where the company drives your social network. There was Zero Degrees and Spoke and Visible Contacts and all these other things. And I went, oh, God, I need to go right now and I need to go fast.
Interesting. Very interesting. And actually, I'd love to pivot a little bit into your book, Blitzscaling. Obviously, this was, as PayPal was before it, a classic example of blitzscaling. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, you were an early investor in Facebook as well, speaking of social companies. And one of the lessons that you have, I want to get into several of the different lessons you have, but you have an offense aspect to this, but you also have the avoid the other blitzscalers. And Facebook and you, obviously not the same company, but in generally similar situations, how did you think about that evolution? You have you have your idea, the way in which you're pursuing it, carving off your unique space, while there's another one that is also blitzscaling, to be sure. How did you think about the kind of yin and yang of the two of you?
Well, there was definitely something of a difficult shadow in the early days, first from Friendster.
Oh, remember right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then MySpace, then Facebook.
Yeah.
Because in each case, the height and volume of the social network arc was so large that when we launched LinkedIn, the only way we could get journalists to cover us is we were Friendster, but for business. Mm. Right? Because they're like, okay, we see there's a whole bunch of people using Friendster, and you're something else. Yeah. Business thingy. Right? And it's like, yeah, but Friendster for Business doesn't really make sense, but it's better to have press than not. So yeah, sure. Yeah. Talk about us how you like.
Make up the headline.
Yes, that's totally fine. And so, but it did go to this kind of ongoing question that until people really started realizing that actually, in fact, you had different expressions of your identity, that like who you'd be connecting with, what you'd be sharing, what your expression or identity would be, like, you know, there would be a whole bunch of people that you would want on your in your work life that you wouldn't be sharing your family pictures with and your vacation pictures. There'd be a bunch of people that you would have in your family life and your personal life that you wouldn't really be connecting with in your personal, you know, in your professional life. That the way that you would fill out your profile, how you represent yourself would be different. So, for example, the fact that you're really trying to make very clear what your professional skills are, what your achievements are, would look odd in a social context. Right? Like, okay, you're a little weird. Right? And so it took people a while to get that. Now, partially because entrepreneurs tend to be I want to get the biggest possible thing they can. So if you went to the social network people, they say, yeah, professional networks are just a small part of what we do. Yes, it's included, but it's part of what we do. Mm-hmm. That's the little small vertical that will go away as opposed to a distinct network and so forth. And that, you know, like I think there were at least three times during the LinkedIn path where there was a multiple week meme kind of that was accepted as true in the press, just like you know, the moon is orbiting the earth. It's like, oh yeah, LinkedIn's over now, right? Mm-hmm. Like Facebook mm-hmm. has done this new thing. Probably the biggest arc of that was the launch of F8 and the platform, saying this is the platform that all social things are now going to be on. LinkedIn will just be built there. Mm-hmm. And you know, each of those times you had to navigate them and it had to make difficult choices around, and this is one of the things that makes entrepreneurship, especially at blitzscale speed, difficult, is you don't have time to research it. You're making the data you have on hand, a difficult choice in a very short time frame to say, where are we making our strategic bets? And in each case, fortunately, I made the right calls of saying, no, actually, in fact, like, for example, the Facebook platform, it's the wrong network. It's the wrong identity system. It's the wrong social buy-in. It's the wrong social contract. There are going to be 30 things that are going to try to be LinkedIn on the Facebook platform. And our belief is that none of them are going to work. And so we are going to monitor. We're going to watch. We're going to see if we're not blinded by our theory, but we're fundamentally going to allocate all our resources to keep building. And within about 3 months, turned out to be, in each of these cases, totally correct.
So the inherited wisdom from the business press was overturned.
Yes.
Fast forward a little bit further. LinkedIn is, of course, a definitive success. You go deeper into investing. You had been an investor. I mentioned an early investor in Facebook, for example. There are other investments: Airbnb, Aurora, Dig, Edmodo, Flickr, just to name a few. Affiliation with Greylock now. And it's from across your experiences as an entrepreneur, as well as an advisor to an investor in the startup community, that the insights that would become the book Blitzscaling came to be. And I'd love to go a little bit deeper into some of those. You've described Blitzscaling as prioritizing speed over efficiency. Talk a little bit about that.
So the full phrase is prioritizing speed over efficiency in an environment of uncertainty, right? Because the uncertainty is a part of this. Mm-hmm. And what it means is there's a set of triggers by which being the first to scale is the entire thing that matters. And one of the ways we try to make this visceral for people is there's this great play and movie called Glengarry Glen Ross. And we're saying in an increasingly hyper-connected world, there are more Glengarry Glen Ross markets. And the reason we use this is because Alec Baldwin's now second best role, his first best is Trump impersonation on SNL. His second best role was in this movie. And it was a sales contest where he said, okay, we're doing a sales contest. First prize is Cadillac. Second prize is steak knives. And third prize is you're fired. And the general awards within Glengarry Glen Ross markets follow this. So it really matters if you're the first to scale, because first to scale is a Cadillac. There can be sometimes room for second. You get the steak knives. That's nice. Third prize, you're fired. So what you have to do is say, if this is one of those kinds of markets, if this has network effects, there's also, by the way, variants like scale effects, like there's a critical mass of scale to get to. And we're playing for that. The first to get there is the Cadillac. So what can we do to prioritize speed? And it isn't just go get big fast. but it's because you want to have a very valuable business at the end. It's not a blind adhesion to size, but it's like, what are the components that put us in a position? So for example, you get to scale fast, but you don't have network effects, may not play that well for you or for society. So how to do that? And what you do is say, here is a bunch, the book is essentially, here's a bunch of things that are not taught at business schools that are generally learned through this network of learning and experience and trial and error and everything else within Silicon Valley and within China and some other places in order to, how can you move as fast as possible to get to scale? And by the way, the paradox of that is that you're trading off a whole bunch of things in efficiency. Because, and part of the environment uncertainty is frequently you may not know what your customer acquisition cost is. You may not know what your long-term value is. You may not know what your unit economics is. Sometimes you may not even know what your business model is. When we were doing this PayPal, we were iterating through like, well, maybe we're a bank and maybe we're doing loans. You know, like maybe we're doing this, maybe we're doing this. Who knows? Right. And when we got down to our kind of like, okay, we really do have one shot now. It was like, okay, we're a master merchant. Right. But you may not even know that. But you know that the player who gets the network first is the player who's going to have the best shot to creating the world-transforming company. And so what are the things you could do in order to make that happen? And the book is essentially a combination of the theory, some of the techniques, and then some of the stories of some of these kind of iconic companies, you know, including PayPal, LinkedIn, and all the rest, who have made this journey.
Yeah, very interesting. And you've talked about the 9 counterintuitive rules of blitzscaling, which you've alluded to. It includes embrace chaos, hire miss right now, not miss right, practice bad management, launch a product that embarrasses you, let fires burn. So I want to actually ask you a little bit about that. It is, as you know, counterintuitive. And moreover, I feel like it's a special kind of leader who can lead through that to motivate a special kind of team who doesn't get disheartened by that. It's not for everyone, leader and team-wise. And it almost seems like, I mean, you really do need to focus on your culture and who you're hiring to be able to thrive in an environment like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yep. So it's definitely the case of how you you have to have a high – make mistakes, learn quickly, survive the mistake, be willing to change your mind, be willing to learn, infinite learning curve, all the stuff super important. One footnote, a part of the reason why we wrote the book was that, and I've actually, this has been kind of a little personal delight in kind of the response to this, is there were two things that we were trying to help companies, even in Silicon Valley, who are doing this. One was distribute the book across the employees. So people go, great, because it doesn't embrace all chaos. It's tolerate these chaoses and know that you're going to get chaos here because you're trying to move quickly while you're still trying to do the right thing across this, right? It's kind of like, how do you make judgment calls on that? And so, because we didn't push this, but like, for example, when Brian Chesky, who's the CEO of Airbnb, co-founder, read the book, he bought it for his entire exec staff who then bought it for their staffs. Because what it helps create is that culture of, here's the things that are okay and like we'll fix later. And here's the things we need to fix now. And here's how we try to tune it so that we know that we're really moving fast, but these kinds of chaos are okay because we can fix them later. And these are the ones we need to fix now. And that kind of thing was like a personal delight in this because it wasn't just to the whole world, the general business audience and everyone else. Like this is how the technology companies of the future are going to be built. These are the ways to see how technology trends are coming. These are the ways to think about when you need, when you're in a Glengarry, Glen Ross market and how you need to play, but also even to Silicon Valley people. And then the second part of it was what we'd been learning about what we call responsible blitzscaling, which we had put as a chapter in, which is as you're growing and becoming multi-threaded, how do you then pre-identify the risks that might be important for your customers, might be important for society, and start investing in them early? It doesn't mean that you will be risk-free, but how are you responsible as you're blitzscaling? Because the truth of the matter is, in a globally competitive market that's super competitive, Glengarry, Glen Ross market, that if you say, well, the company that has no ethics responsibility goes really fast, and the one that goes, oh, I'm going to take my social responsibilities and go really slow, then all we're going to get is the unethical ones. Mm-hmm. So the question is how to get the ethical fast ones and how to blend that and how to add that into your tool kit while not slowing down. And both of those have been delights for me personally in doing the book. And the key question comes down to, and this is part of your talent question, is a willingness to know that you're operating in an environment and risk uncertainty, which, by the way, means you fail sometimes, right? There is no, oh, it's risk and uncertainty, and I always do it. That does not happen. But you do it as individuals, you do it as a group, but you are focused on the triage to what are the key things to win the game, and you're correcting constantly. And sometimes it still means you don't succeed, but you have a higher probability by being part of this infinite learning curve.
Given the amount of change that will happen for all the reasons that you describe, what's the role of strategy in this sort of an environment? I mean, it's not setting 10-year plans and working against those plans. It probably isn't necessarily, at least in the early stages, great specificity that you know everyone is driving towards. It needs to be sort of, I'm guessing, stakes planted in the ground, but still malleable, not driven so deeply that they don't move. So what role do you see that playing, and how does that differ maybe from past decades?
So strategy always has to be set against what the pace of the competitive environment looks like. So for example, if you have an industrial age where it's like we build a plant and you know, and your competitive scope is decade, right, or decades or years, then of course your strategy should be measured in that kind of time frame. And usually the time frame is measured by competition. Is what speed is your competition moving at? Because if you're moving at a slower speed, you almost always lose, right? Sometimes you can have a clever strategy that the competition is not building the long term the way it should, and it plays out. But it's a very brittle. It's kind of like putting all of your chips in a roulette table on like one number, right, or two numbers. Right. So it's kind of as opposed to like you know black or red. I'm going to get the limits of my metaphor. Never having used a roulette wheel, right? But I've seen it on the James Bond films, and so that's like really important. Now what then happens is it's still there's deep role for strategy because the question is like your earlier question about like for example LinkedIn and Facebook. It's like well. What's really going on in this game? What are the key things to work or not? If part of strategy is you have a theory of the case that's much better that will cause your capital investments, which things you have to get right earlier than your competition, how you prioritize different customers, which risk trade-offs are you willing to take, how much do you invest in your product before you show it off and how much do you not? And there's lots of different calculus that goes into that. So there's still very deep role for strategy and all this stuff. Now, the one thing that most people mistake in strategy is as the time frames get compressed, then what becomes much more important in strategy is a capability of reacting quickly to opportunity. Because when you're on a decade-long strategy, it's very hard to have the visibility of what the decade opportunity looks like. So you're more planning from your current assets. You're kind of thinking it through from current position out, looking at your competition. When you're in a market that moves in weeks and months, right, then part of what you're doing is you're actually saying part of my strategy is paying attention to what's going on around me so that I can learn and adapt to things that are unpredictable about like what product might work or what technology might come on the scene or what my competitors might be doing. And that serendipitous monitor to respond, adjust quickly needs to be part of the toolkit, including the strategic toolkit. And that becomes a different conception of how strategy plays. And like one of the masters of scales things, we talk about the OODA loop, right, as one of the key things to how to think about that.
Yeah. And so that's one of three key techniques you talk about, strategy innovation. The other two are business model innovation and management innovation. Can you talk a little bit more about those?
Yep. So business model innovation, it's really key to have connected to when you're doing blitzscaling because usually you're piling in a huge amount of capital, both financial and human. Mm-hmm. You're usually deploying it at some degree of ridiculously inefficient, right? Like hiring 2x the people in 3 months, 6 months. Nobody can do that without massive chaos and inefficiency. And so what you need to do is you need to say, at the other side, I am likely to have a really interesting business model. Right now, it may be that I'm putting in the components now. I should at least have a theory about how that may play out. So, you know, one of the benefits of network effects is a business model built on a network. The network tends to be super difficult to rebuild once it's thing. So you can actually build out your business model on top of it. So my Series A pitch and my Series B pitch to Greylock for LinkedIn was, it's good that we haven't done revenue yet, because you want to build the network first and you want to be totally focused on it. That shows you we know what we're doing. We will get to revenue later, right? And this is a little bit of also a pitch to entrepreneurs, which is take things that that your audience may think are weaknesses and position them as why they're strengths, mm-hmm. right? Because if you're not doing that and you don't know how to do that, that makes you weaker as an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the business model component. And usually in the consumer internet, each massive company at scale has a unique business model. In the LinkedIn case, it's the intersection of enterprise and consumer with the network as an underlier. You know, as you know, in the social network case, it tends to be the sponsored ads in the feed. You know, it's AdWords for Google. I mean, there's a stack of things where that becomes a really unique thing that is constructed within that environment, within the use case, within how that vibrant ecosystem works. And so it's really important to be thinking about it, even if the implementation is years into it. And for example, Google didn't have AdWords when they were starting. They thought they were going to be enterprise search, but they were always thinking about it. They were thinking about what their plan B might be, their plan C, their plan D. And then when they said, oh, we need to do advertising, it was like, oh, Overture did this thing, but we have some better ideas about how to do that and how to build it out. Management innovation. So the key thing is, in building a company, to realize that you're all going on this learning journey together. And it's not just learning as individuals. And usually you don't have time to do a lot of coursework. You don't have time to read lots of books. You might or might not have time to listen to podcasts. Hopefully this one, hopefully Masters of Scale, but you might or might not. And so the key thing is, we're learning together. And so what you want to do is set up the intensity of that learning environment. So you want to hire people who are learners as executives. You want to have a culture which spreads explicit information and learning as much as possible in terms of operating fast, but also sharing here's what we're learning, here's what we're changing, here's what we're doing. For example, one of the things that I learned from PayPal, from Peter, was you need to be quick decision making. So like one of the things I have is a tool that I did not have at SocialNet, learned by being at PayPal, was when you're confronted with every single decision, what decision would you make on the spot? Not like, oh, I need to talk to so-and-so and so forth. Like, if you were to make a decision right now, what would it be? It could be hiring someone, could be making a complete a change in business model. What would that decision be right now? Then what does the cost curve look like for me to go out and talk to specific people, research a certain thing, understand something specific? What time frame do I have? What's the cost benefit I anticipate of these additional things? Should I make the decision right now? Should I delay for a specific thing, not to feel comfortable, mm-hmm. but for a specific thing? Because the speed at which you're making these decisions are really key. So you want a culture of doing that. You want a culture of we make decisions quickly together. And that's the kind of thing that you're composing that's coherent across all these companies. Now, culture is super important in businesses, and culture can be different. This culture can be, we're all high IQ and we can tell each other whether we're idiots and all the rest of that stuff, and that's how we operate, and that's who we are, because the people who want to be part of that culture will join that. It will be the, ooh, that's the one for me, and the other people who are A players, that's the one not for me. Mm-hmm. This one can be, we're professional, we study things deeply, we only argue on the basis of data, right? We make sure that everyone's voice is heard, right? All of these cultures are viable business cultures. You want to have the baseline of being respectful to all people, but like how we play. And the way to fundamentally, a couple of cultural tests, like one is, not all A players should want, like, we are an A player company. That doesn't work. Which are the unique A players that work in your company that you form coherent team around? Second thing about culture is, there's a funny way of looking at culture, which is, culture is the worst behavior that you'll tolerate, right? That's the downside. There's an upside of culture, a downside of culture. And so, well, okay, what's that, right? Is that, well, we allow people to be a little snippy and anger and so forth and so on. Is it, you know, because these would be, that'd be okay. I mean, you know, not ideal, but okay. Like, you could see how that play out. We tolerate So like, for example, in blitzscaling, we say we tolerate bad management. That's
right.
Maybe we're not doing one-on-ones. And we do no one, we're not doing one-on-ones this year, right? We're doing none of that. We don't tolerate criminal management. You, right. you have a sexual harassment problem in your company, stamp it out. Mm-hmm. You're like unacceptable. Like you'd rather, and part of it, you'd rather lose, right, than tolerate that, mm-hmm. right? And so that's the kind of thing. And by the way, usually that one, that you'll lose if you tolerate it. So you shouldn't anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway.
Stamp it out sooner.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So that's the kind of thing that in terms of management practice, but it's an emphasis on speed and learning. And then it's an emphasis on defining an identity of who you are and on being clear both on the upside and downside of what that is.
As an investor, how do you project forward somebody who has an idea and a small team, whether or not they have the necessary ingredients to blitzscale?
Well, it's always a risk assessment mm-hmm. Because, again, maybe they do, maybe you don't, and maybe you did and you don't anymore, and maybe you didn't, and maybe you do now. So there's no set of predictors. But a lot of it tends to be you're pretty hungry for the win. You're savvy about learning. You care a lot about the mission that you're on. It's not just a mercenary thing, but like the – I'm not just saying I want to change the world. Like this is kind of the HBO Silicon Valley thing. Like I have reverse double encryption because I'm here to change the world. It's like, no. I actually legitimately could make a good impassioned case to a skeptic about why what I'm doing is better for society and better for the world. All in, everything else considered. And so that also. And you put those things together, and then it's kind of that's a set of factors, and then there's some art to the judgment too.
You mentioned that China is the land of blitzscaling, and it wasn't so long ago that people hypothesized that there weren't the necessary ingredients in China to really compete with Silicon Valley. It's not an immigrant culture the way that we are. There's venture capital was not as embraced. Even just risk tolerance was different. And my, how things have changed. What are some of the aspects of China that particularly impress you, such that you gave it this moniker?
Well, so the most central one is prior to China, when I went anywhere from Silicon Valley, everything seemed a little in slow motion, right? It's like, oh yeah, you know, we move faster. Go to China, they move faster, right? So the speed at which they move. So for example, when they have a corporate strategy priority, even a big company, what they'll do is they'll say, oh, this is really important, like Tencent. Say, well, it's really important we do messaging on the mobile phone. So we'll start three different groups in three different cities. And they're going to compete with each other as well as everything else because we want one of them to win. Right? Which, you know, seems crazy. Like the normal management theory here would be like, no, you put your best people on it and you take your shot and it's the one thing. Partially, you don't have time. You can't fund three different companies, you know, three different locations. You don't have the raw talent everyone else for it, which, of course, having a mass amount of talent is one of the things it allows. They are also, by the way, and this is one of the things I'm, you know, I hope we upgrade our practice over time, but they're in the way of learnings is everything that's written in the tech business world in English is translated in Chinese in minutes after it's written. Their stuff is written in Chinese that's never translated in English. And they read all this stuff, right? They pay attention to it. So it's an intensity of learning drawing from everywhere. And then the final thing is a little bit of like the Tom Friedman, you know, kind of act and live like an immigrant, because even though they're there, they're hungry for it. So they Lei Jun, who's the founder of Xiaomi, when I first met him, said, "Well, you Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, you're lazy." I was like, "Really? Don't feel lazy?" All right. He's like, "Okay, so at Xiaomi, this is when they had, I think, 10,000 people. Our policy is 996. 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week, you're discoverable at your desk." Right. And when I was talking to some of the executives that worked for him, it was a not atypical experience that what would happen is the executive would be home at sleep and the phone would ring at midnight saying, "We're making a decision. Come into the office."
Right now.
Right now. Yeah. Right. And so now that's probably not sustainable. There's a question, but it's competitively strong and powerful and leads to a set of interesting blitzscaling techniques, because blitzscaling is always a phase. That's never forever. Mm-hmm. It's phases and different things and so forth. And most often, for the new companies that are coming on the stage, it's the phase in which you establish your ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And so, central to that. But anyway, those are the kinds of things that were just stunning to learn from studying China.
That's really interesting. And you've also talked about the application of the concepts of blitzscaling to larger organizations. Talk a little bit about that. Obviously, a lot of what we've been discussing has been the entrepreneur's journey, those early stages, you know, your fight for survival. How do you enact something like this in a going concern?
So it certainly is doable. Like, for example, now it was still a younger entrepreneurial company, but Amazon was thought to be a bookstore and launched AWS. Mm-hmm. It was the cover, once again, not to pick on business media too much, but it was a cover of a bunch of business magazines mm-hmm. saying Amazon should just mind the store, shouldn't be doing this new thing, yet AWS is the new revolution. So it is possible to launch these things. You have to have buy-in from your investors, buy-in from, because enough people in Amazon were like, we're buying into you and your long-term vision, that we'll buy in even though there's this other criticism, and we'll want to see this happen. It's one of the things that allows, extraordinary journeys like Elon Musk's, with Tesla saying, look, I have this vision and here I go, and we'll give you the credit that you may get to that extraordinary, vision and path. And so I think it is doable. It does require buy-in from investors, to do blitzscaling. The other thing you have to think about when you're a traditional company is just say, if someone's blitzscaling an area that matters to me, this gets down to a judgment call that's somewhat like the LinkedIn call with Facebook and so forth, which is, okay, what's their blitzscaling going to do? Like, say I can't blitzscale, and what's it going to do? Because it'll always have a big impact. They may blow themselves up. Maybe that's not going to work. But if they blow themselves up, what's the ripples going to look like, and how do we navigate that if that's our bet? Or do we change? Do we shift a little bit and say, okay, we leave room for that, and we do our own thing? Right. I think a little bit is like the IBM saying, okay, we're not doing hardware anymore. We're going to do services. Mm-hmm. Right. Like this is the way that we're going to change to play, and we're going to stay a significant company as we're doing it because we're changing this way. And that kind of thing is the kind of thing of the reason why, more or less, I think any company that's beginning to be transformed by software needs to pay attention to the blitzscaling techniques, because they're most firmly rooted within software. It does happen everywhere. It does happen within, it usually has an indirect software component, like, Zara and fast fashion and so forth. I mean, there's places where it's like, well, it's fast fashion. And it's like, yeah, but they're collecting information from the salespeople. They're aggregating it. They're doing the design cycle and software. They're using robotic amplified manufacturing. So there's a bunch of different things in order to get that fashion, in a small number of weeks back to the store. But there's a set of things where you say, okay, as my industry is much more in touch with this, I need to be much more cognizant of these kinds of techniques. I need to be seeing, do I deploy them? Are other people deploying them? How do I respond to them? And what's the way I need to operate in order to do that?
Hmm. Well, Reid Hoffman, it's been a great conversation. Really appreciate you taking time. Congratulations on your terrific book, as well as your great success in your business career. Thank you for taking a little time to talk about each.
My pleasure. Thank you. It's fun.
Excellent.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Shailesh Prakash, the Chief Information Officer and Chief Product Officer of The Washington Post.